This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Iva Glišić, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Barbara Martin about her book, Dissident Histories in the Soviet Union, From De-Stalinization to Perestroika. Now, Barbara is a postdoctoral researcher within the Department of History at the University of Basel, and she's a specialist in Soviet history of Soviet dissent. Now, Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Barbara, it's wonderful to have you with us, and I was wondering if we can start by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Basically, I got my PhD from the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva in 2016. The book I am presenting today was my doctoral dissertation, which I published, and currently I'm working on the second book project. I think I will mention this at the end. So my interest is generally in the history of Soviet dissent, and currently also the history of religion in the late Soviet Union.
Fantastic. And maybe we can start by just exploring a little bit this history of Soviet dissent, and you can tell us how you became interested in this topic, and especially in this topic of how Soviet dissent manifested itself in the domain of historical research and writing.
Well, this came about because I wrote my master thesis on the memory of Stalin era repression. My thesis was on the history of the memory of the Holodomor, this man-made famine in Ukraine. And I was interested in how it played in the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, so in post-Soviet times. And this drew me to the question of how this very important periods, historical periods of the Soviet Union, this history of Soviet repression was remembered already in Soviet times. I knew that Nikita Khrushchev had denounced Stalin's crimes at the 20th Party Congress in 1956, and I was interested in what had been the reactions to this secret speech in the 1960s, 1970s. And of course, here, the most important work, which I'm sure all of you know about, is The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which was published in 1973 in the West, and which was such an important work in revealing the history of Stalin-era repression, the Gulag. And so I started out with this quite superficial knowledge about this period, and I started looking at other authors who had published on these themes and who were working from within the Soviet Union. So this is how it all started out.
Right, interesting. And when you mentioned your Solzhenitsyn, he's one of the four authors that you follow through your book. So tell us a little bit about the four main characters that really are the core of your study, how you selected these authors, and how did you go about finding your sources and the source base for this study?
Mm-hmm. So there's basically four main figures, as you said. One of them is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Another one is Roy Medvedev, who published a famous book entitled Let History Judge, also about the history of Stalin-era repression, which was published in 1971. Then there's Anton Antonov Avsyenko, who was the son of a famous Bolshevik revolutionary, Vladimir Antonov Avsyenko. So this revolutionary was repressed during the 1930s, and Anton as well went to the Gulag. And as a result of this, he had a great desire also to denounce Stalin's crimes. And in 1980, he published a book, which later appeared in English under the title The Times of Stalin, Portrait of a Tyranny. And then the last figure is Alexander Nekrich, who was a professional historian in the Soviet Union, who published a book on the beginning of the Second World War in Russia, what they call the Great Patriotic War. The book was entitled June 22nd, 1941, which is the first day of the war in the Soviet Union. And it denounced the way in which Stalin failed to prepare the Soviet Union to this, the Nazi Germany's invasion. So the way I selected these figures is that I wanted to pick figures who had published historical research, not just memoirs or literary works, because there had been a number of memoirs and literary works published on the history of Stalin-era repression, but I was interested in people who had actually done research on the subject. And then it was important that these works had been published already in the Soviet era, because there were a number of researchers who wrote, as they said, for the drawer, which meant that they knew that this was not going to get published. They nonetheless wrote. But for me, it was important that these were works which actually had an impact on readers. I also wanted to concentrate on Soviet Russia because there were obviously the same processes happening in various Soviet republics. But then there were different dynamics, the question of nationalism. If we take, for example, Ukraine, there were obviously people writing also about Soviet power in Ukraine, and the problematics are quite different. So I wanted to concentrate on Soviet Russia. So basically, the four figures I selected were the most prominent, I would say, but of course, my book is not complete. There are other interesting figures I could have picked. And then while I was doing my PhD research, there was one case which I examined, but which didn't make it into this book, because I also published another book in Russian on the subject and several articles. And this is the historical collection Pamyat, which was a kind of journal. There were five issues of which were published in the late 70s and early 80s by a group of young amateur historians. This book was published in Russian in 2017, so I don't really examine this case also, although it's a fascinating one. And concerning the sources that I used, So I was lucky to get access to the personal papers of Roy Medvedev, which is like a huge corpus of very different sources. And this is in Moscow, and then also the papers of Alexander Nekrich, which are located at the Hoover Institution Archives at Stanford University. This is also a very interesting corpus of sources. With Anton Antonov-Avsyenko, he was still alive when we met, and although his papers were not at a state archive, could actually stay at his place and go through his papers. So this was also an interesting experience. The only figure I could not really cover extensively was Alexander Solzhenitsyn, because his personal archive is not open to researchers at the moment. But there were some published sources that I could use concerning Solzhenitsyn, for example, the letters he received when he published his first literary work, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. These are letters which are important for the publication of the Gulag Archipelago, because after this first publication in 1962, he received hundreds of letters from people throughout the country, because he was the first person to speak about repression in literature. And these letters, they were letters of a former Gulag prisoners who told him about their experience. So this was an important source for him for the Gulag Archipelago, and these letters were in part published. So these various materials, and then there were also the archives of samizdat material. Samizdat is basically in the Soviet era this kind of uncensored network of distribution, so to say, of various texts. So when people would actually reproduce on their typewriters texts that they like and make several copies, which they would distribute to other people. So there are archival repositories of the samizdat texts in Budapest at the Open Society Archive, and also in Bremen in Germany. So basically, these are the materials that I use.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a very wide range of sources and very different entry points into the story of these four history writers. Now, I'm interested that your discussion of dissent histories begins with Nikita Khrushchev's famous speech at the 20th Congress of the Communist Party in 1956. This is the famous speech, right, that where he denounces Stalin, the cult of personality, and the crimes that Stalin committed. I was wondering if you can tell us about the subsequent process of de-Stalinization and the impact that this had on history writing and history scholarship in the Soviet Union.
Yes, so the secret speech was a very important moment. It doesn't mean that the Soviet people didn't know anything about repression. Quite a lot of them had relatives who had been arrested, some of them who had died in the Gulag or been shot. But every one of them thought that this was an individual mistake, and no one had an idea of the whole scale of this terror. And even Nikita Khrushchev said that he didn't realize the whole scale of this until he actually asked people to do research on this for the secret speech. And so this is called a secret speech, but it actually wasn't really secret, because it was first read during a closed session at the 20th Party Congress, but then it was read throughout the country in various party meetings, also in work collectives, in the Communist youth meetings as well. So it means that there were millions of people who had actually heard about it, or either heard the speech itself or heard that there had been such a speech. By the way, there's an interesting book by Kathleen Smith entitled 1956, Summer 1956, which it tells the story of the year 1956, and the whole discussions throughout the country that this raised. And it raised obviously a lot of turmoil, and the Soviet leadership didn't really know what to do with this, because they didn't want the Soviet people to start revolting, and so it was really Khrushchev had opened the Pandora's box with this secret speech, and then they tried to close it again. So there was. Between 1956 and 1961, there was a succession of thaws and freezes. And in historical writing, this was complicated for historians, because some of them tried to use this new freedom to speak about new topics, but there were also repressions against those who were too bold. So, for example, Eduard Bojalov, who was the deputy editor in chief of Vaprosy Istorii, Questions of History, a famous historical journal, tried to stimulate the participation of readers with conferences and try to open up new themes. And then he was criticized at the highest level in the Central Committee of the party and for these discussions, and he was dismissed. So this discussion was quite quickly closed, and then things changed only after the 22nd Party Congress in 1961, when this time the denunciation of Stalin was public for the first time, which means that all the speeches at the Congress were published in the press. And then there was this very symbolical gesture that Stalin's body, which was in this mausoleum on Red Square, along with Lenin's body, was actually removed from the mausoleum and reburied by the Kremlin wall. So this really showed that he was no longer this sacred figure. And after this, we have the beginning of a short-lived wave of publication of anti-Stalinist works, especially literary works. And this starts with One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Solzhenitsyn, as I mentioned. But this doesn't last very long, because this work was published in 1962, and then already in 1964, Nikita Khrushchev is ousted from power by his political opponents, and this de-Stalinization theme is already discarded along with Khrushchev's other policies. So there's this new shift. But there were a few historians in the 1960s who were able to do some work on previously taboo themes. I can cite, for example, Viktor Danilov, who was from the Institute of History of at the Academy of Sciences of the USSR, and he began to study the history of the collectivization of Soviet agriculture. And this was a topic which was very politically sensitive, because it raised the question of the repression of the so-called kulaks, and also the history of the famine that was caused by the confiscation of grain, especially in Ukraine, but also Kazakhstan and other regions. And Danilov was never allowed to publish this monograph because it was too sensitive. And then Alexander Nekrich, which I considered in my research, also tried to tackle sensitive subject, the question of Stalin's role in the Second World War. Nikita Khrushchev himself had criticized Stalin for his wartime management in the secret speech. But nevertheless, Nekrich was really tackling a complicated subject, and he managed to publish his book in 1965, just before there was a change in this official policy, but eventually he was excluded from the party for the publication of this book in 1967.
So that's interesting that you mentioned Nekrich and Solzhenitsyn and their reactions to and their writing in this period. What about Medvedev and Ovsenko's work at this point?
Yes, so I mentioned the professional historians, but then there were also people who were not professionals who started writing on this this theme of Stalinism, Stalin era repression. And so both Antonov Avsyenko and Roy Medvedev were not professional historians, but they had a personal interest in the subject. For Roy Medvedev, it was the fact that his own father was arrested during the terror and died in the Gulag. So he wanted to write a work on the subject, and he himself was a party member. He had joined the party after his father was officially rehabilitated in 1956. And his wish was to help the Communist Party overcome this this dark period of its history, draw the lessons of this tragic event, and move on towards a democratization of public life. And he started writing this historical research in this context with the idea that it could be published in the Soviet Union. He even showed it to several secretaries of the Central Committee. One of them was even Yuri Andropov, who would later on become first head of the KGB and ultimately the General Secretary of the Soviet Union. And at first, before Khrushchev was ousted from power, there were some quite positive reactions to this research. But things also changed after 1965 for Medvedev, who was ultimately also excluded from the party and ended up publishing his work in the West in 1971. And for Antonov Avsyenko, there was also a similar process. First, he tried to work within the system. He was interested, obviously, in his father's figure, because Vladimir Antonov Avsyenko was this very iconical figure who had arrested the provisional government in the during the October Revolution, this very charismatic figure. So for him, it was really important to rehabilitate his father publicly, and he published first this biography of his father in 1965. But he was disappointed by the reactions to this work. He had the impression that his father was still considered a Trotskyist, and all this this opprobrium around his father's name was still there. So this bitterness that he had turned into a new project, which was this biography of Stalin, which was it's a very, very dark, negative portrait of Stalin, which he also ultimately published in the West, because it was clear that he could not do so in the Soviet Union. And then if we take Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he also started by publishing officially One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, But he encountered also this negative reactions. First, he was acclaimed as like this new famous author whose works were extremely popular. But after a while, he was no longer able to publish in the Soviet Union, and his two important novels, The First Circle and The Cancer Ward, had to be published in the West because they were not accepted by Soviet censorship. And during this time, he also began work on the Gulag Archipelago, based first on the letters of political prisoners he received, and also all kinds of materials that he managed to collect. And it was clear that this work could not appear in the Soviet Union, so he already wrote this with the intent of publishing it in the West.
I was really struck by the fact that these four figures that you've selected all write different histories with different motivations, and they have very interesting engagement with those histories and the different approaches. I'm interested in what happens in the next stage when we see Leonid Brezhnev come to power. How do debates about the Soviet past evolve at that point, and how does the history writing of these four dissidents evolve as well?
Thank you. So yes, I mentioned that there's a change after Leonid Brezhnev comes to power, and this is connected with the fact that this new Soviet leadership has the impression that there has been too much talk about the Stalin-era crimes, although in our view, obviously, it was very limited, this discussion, but there's this impression that there has been too much blackening of the Soviet past and that we should create a more positive view of Soviet history.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And so progressively, there's these themes are excluded from the public debate. And this is also due to the influence of various figures in the Soviet leadership and the Central Committee who could be considered as Stalinists. And one of them is Sergei Trapeznikov, who is a friend of Brezhnev from the time when they worked together in Moldavia. And he was appointed head of the Central Committee Department for Science and Higher Education. He himself was a historian, and he really did a lot to launch repression against those dissidents or figures who thought differently, who wanted to speak about the Stalin-era repression. So he played an important role in getting Alexander Nikitich excluded from the party for publishing this work on the Second World War. he also played a role in getting Roy Medvedev excluded from the party, although at this stage, Medvedev had not yet published Let History Judge, but his manuscript was already circulating among certain circles, and there was a fear that he would publish this work in the West. So this is a figure who really tried to suppress the theme of Soviet repression from the public debate. And starting from the end of 1965, beginning of 1966, there's a lot of fears within this liberal Soviet intelligentsia that there will be an official rehabilitation of Stalin. And this is justified by these various moves. For example, in 1965, there's the celebration of the 20th anniversary of the victory in the Second World War. And in his speech, Brezhnev mentioned Stalin just once, but this is still something symbolic, and then there's applause. So there's this feeling that at the forthcoming 23rd Party Congress, Brezhnev might rehabilitate Stalin officially. And in January 1966, we have this open letter of 25 prominent representatives of the intelligentsia who call on Brezhnev not to rehabilitate Stalin. And there's throughout the late 60s, we have waves of such letters which protest against the publication of official positive mentions of Stalin in the press. At the 23rd Party Congress, Brezhnev doesn't actually rehabilitate Stalin. So we don't know exactly what happened behind the scene, but it seems like there were contradictory lobbying forces within the leadership, those who wanted to rehabilitate Stalin, and then there were also these important voices within what we would call now civil society, although at the time it was maybe anachronic to speak of civil society, but we have these voices against such rehabilitation. And as a result, there's a kind of compromise, which is not to have an official rehabilitation, but also not to mention Stalin-era repression anymore. And this is basically the kind of compromise we have during the Brezhnev era. This is also in 1969, for example, there's the 90th anniversary of Joseph Stalin's birth, and there's a lot of positive publications about him in the press by various people, memoirs, etc., which also again raises a lot of worries concerns that he might be rehabilitated, but then ultimately on Stalin's anniversary, there's a small article in newspaper Pravda in which this fact is acknowledged, but there's not an actual official rehabilitation. And we actually have the transcript of the discussion around this article in the Politburo, in which we see that there's this unease with the subject, and they want to show that they're not actually rehabilitating him, but at the same time they have to do something. So it's a subject that it's not like an actual official rehabilitation is taking place as people thought at the time.
Right, and at this point in time, during that is Brezhnev era, what are the works that are most well known by the four authors that you look into, whether within Soviet Union itself or abroad?
You mean the works by these authors?
Yeah, what I guess I'm interested, what are some of the recognizable works and topics that they are working on at this point in time?
These authors, well, there's obviously the topic of the Gulag, which is in the Gulag Archipelago, which is a very important one. Well, Let History Judge is more like a history of Stalinism. And first, Roy Medvedev starts with this chronology, which is quite restricted, and which starts basically in 1934 when Kirov was assassinated. It's usually in the secret speech by Khrushchev, it's considered as the starting point of the repression. But then over time, he expands the chronology. He focuses not just on the 30s, but he starts looking at the 1920s when there's a repression of the opposition within the party. And then he looks also at the 40s when there were campaigns also against campaigns of repression within Soviet science, the arts, etc., and anti-Semitic also repression. So this is one aspect. Alexander Nekrich focuses on the war, but then afterwards he also starts looking at other topics. For example, he starts writing a history of the deportation of small minorities which were deported during the Second World War. For example, we know about the Chechens, but there were a lot of other small people who were deported because they were suspected of collaborating with the Germans during the occupation, for example. And so this is one theme. And then, yeah, Antonov Avsyenko focuses also on Stalin's figure. Obviously, Stalin is this very central figure. Although for Solzhenitsyn, for example, Stalin is not an important figure in itself. He considers that the whole regime is criminal, and he considers that Stalin was only working in the footsteps of Lenin. It's just a continuation of what had started right after the October Revolution. So these are the main topics, I would say.
Yes, and each more controversial, I guess, than the next one.
Yes.
And some of them, of course, even to this day. Now, your next portion of the book focuses on the period of glasnost and perestroika. Things changed quite substantially at this point in time, in terms of the public discourse that takes place in the Soviet Union. So walk us through the dissident history writing during this period.
So yes, there's this change, what do we call this policy of glasnost, leads to the publication of works that were previously banned. So first of all, we have the publication of literary works on the subject. For example, one important work is Children of the Arbat by Anatoly Rybakov. These are works that deal with the figure of Stalin and the Stalin era in a literary way, and they're more acceptable to the Soviet leadership than historical research. So this starts already in 1987. Then there's films, for example, Repentance by Tengiz Abuladze, Georgian director, which deals in a metaphoric way with this question of repression. And these works produce an important effect on the public. They reveal these crimes in a new way. But during the first period, the authors I mentioned are not published because they're their dissidents. They have been published in the West, and so they have this image which is still quite negative for the Soviet authorities. And then next stage comes in 1988. In April 1988, we have a Soviet journal that interviews Roy Medvedev, and this opens up a new period. Anton Antonov-Avtsenko is also interviewed during that year, and their works start being published around this period, first in journal publications, then they come out as books. And it's only in 1989 that we have the publication of the Gulag Archipelago in the summer of 89, which is obviously the most important publication, which everyone has been expecting. And the Soviet intelligentsia has been lobbying for a year for this to happen. But for the Soviet leadership, it was a very complicated issue because Solzhenitsyn was openly anti-communist, which is very different from Roy Medvedev's position, for example, who was always a communist and who undertook his research really from with this perspective in mind that the Stalin era was a limited period of time during which there was this lawlessness, repression, but that this can be overcome to actually build democratic socialism. And Solzhenitsyn has a very different perspective. For him, the whole communist period is a period of lawlessness, and the whole system has to be abolished for a new Russia to be reborn based on new basis. So it was more complicated to publish him. And then if we look at Alexander Nikrich during this period, so he had emigrated in 1976, being of Jewish origin, and he had settled in the United States. He worked at Harvard University, and he had published also this important work on the history of the Soviet Union, Utopia in Power, with French historian Michel Heller. And this work was never published in the Soviet Union in Soviet times. It appeared only in post-Soviet Russia because, again, it was clearly anti-communist. So this was not acceptable to the authorities.
Yeah, I think it's you're interesting the way that your book shows that this is not, and emphasizes really, that this is not a unified bloc in terms of this dissent, but rather the within these this is in history writing their very different positions and also the pathways that these authors take. I was very surprised. I think you mentioned at one point that Nekrich also came to Australia at the Australian National University. Is that correct?
I don't remember, but it might be that he traveled. He traveled to several countries. I remember Japan, and I think they could have been also Australia, because yeah, he was he did not have like a stable position. He had to live off rent, and so he took invited professorships in various places as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the sort of global aspect of these Soviet dissident histories as well that appears throughout your work. One of the very interesting themes that comes through your study is this problem of truthfulness and objectivity in dissident histories. Can you tell us a little bit about the sources that these four authors used to write their histories and write about the Soviet past?
Yes, so there were indeed various political perspectives from communist to anti-communist. And this is obviously natural even in any kind of historical writing. The author brings his or her perspective. But this is even more so in the case I am studying, because these are people who did not even consider that objectivity was something possible or even desirable. They did not, except for Mnekrich, who was a professional historian, the other authors were not professionals, and they saw themselves also as political actors who had a role to play in ensuring that the history of political repression was not forgotten. There was obviously no objectivity on the part of the Soviet leadership, which controlled what could be published and what could not be published. So they felt that they had a role to play in ensuring this history was not forgotten. And they had their own perspective also as victims of these repressions, both Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Antonov Avseenko went through the Gulag, 8 years for Solzhenitsyn and 13 years for Antonov Avseenko. So obviously this has a huge impact, and they did not consider that they can speak about these things in an objective way, and for them there was no such goal. And then the other aspect that influenced also their narrative was the sources they used, which were predominantly oral testimonies. The reason for this was that they did not have access to archival documents. So they had to do with the sources that they had at hand. I mentioned the letters of political prisoners that Solzhenitsyn received. And in the case of Roy Medvedev or Antonov Avseenko, these were also oral testimonies, primarily of old party members, old Bolsheviks who had been participants of the October Revolution, the Civil War, and who had occupied high functions within the party apparatus, and who had later been repressed in the Stalin era. And these were key witnesses who could say a lot about the whole functioning of the party machine under Stalin. So these sources were really important. And when these books were published in the West, Western historians were very interested because they themselves had not had access to these sources. But this raised also the question of the truthfulness of these testimonies, because historians who work with oral history know that this can be a very unreliable source. Obviously, human memory is not perfect. Then there's the subjectivity of the person, who may not remember things accurately or who may remember selectively. So for the historian who uses such sources, it's always a challenge to tell the truth from the rest. So there were a lot of criticism when these works were published during Perestroika about mistakes. And I think this is unavoidable in any kind of historical work, but this was even more so in the context in which these works were written. And for example, Roy Medvedev gave his manuscript to read to hundreds of people, and he really tried to minimize these mistakes. He also wrote many different successive versions of the same work, and each time he would improve it and correct those mistakes that he uncovered. But someone like Antonov Avseenko faced the challenge that he was almost blind, and he was very isolated. So there were obviously even more mistakes in this kind of work. So this was a problem. And yeah, in terms of the sources that they used, apart from oral testimonies, we can also mentioned the official publication newspaper cuttings. They had been articles published, for example, obituaries of commemorative articles on different party figures, which had been published during the thaw while Khrushchev was still in power. And Roy Medvedev, for example, worked a lot with these articles, collecting this material. So there were some sources they could use, although they were quite limited.
And in relation to that, and you've already touched a little bit on this in your talk, but I was wondering whether there is a difference, or how would you explain the difference between writing about Soviet history in the country, within Soviet Union, and in exile?
Yes, in my work, I look at the case of Roy Medvedev, who remained in the Soviet Union for his whole career. What I call inner immigration, because he was a dissident and he published his works in the West, but at the same time he lived in the Soviet Union. And then there's the counterpoint, which is the case of Alexander Nekrich, who chose immigration in the 1976 and continued his historical writing in the West. So it's interesting, of course, to compare these two perspectives, and of course, this was a very different position. Roy Medvedev, who remained in the Soviet Union, had the constraint that he risked imprisonment any time if he wrote something that was too sensitive, and we can see that Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when he published the Gulag Archipelago, he was almost immediately arrested, and they sent him on a plane to Germany. So he was he found himself in exile against his own will. So Roy Medvedev really wanted to avoid such a fate. He wanted to be able to remain in the Soviet Union and to continue his work, and this meant that to a certain extent there was a degree of self censorship. Although he didn't admit it fully. For example, he told me that he wouldn't criticize those leaders who were currently in power. And this was a strategic way of avoiding repression. For example, he published a book on a biography of Brezhnev, but only after Brezhnev had died. And he published a biography of Khrushchev, but also again when Khrushchev was no longer in power. So there was this degree of adaptation to the context of possible repression. And this allowed Roy Medvedev to remain in liberty. He was not arrested, although he suffered various forms of threats and pressure. Had several house searches and was warned several times to stop his so-called anti-Soviet activities. But he was able to continue working. And if we look at Alexander Nekrich in the West, he emigrated because in the Soviet Union he could no longer publish his work, and the choice of emigration was the choice to continue his career, and he had much more liberty. But at the same time, of course, being isolated from the country you're writing about is also a different kind of challenge, and he faced the material difficulties of being this emigre scholar who had to find grants to fund his research, and he had to forsake the comfort that he had as an official historian in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, one of the things that I was wondering if you came across any kind of big surprises during your research, whether it's in terms of sources or conclusions that you came to in writing your book.
So I would say that for me, the most important aspect that maybe what surprised me most was to find out that there was really this progressive change of orientation of these various figures, that first they had tried to adapt to this this context of the Khrushchev era, when there was the so-called thaw, when there were some limited publication about the history of the Stalin era, and all of these figures tried in one way or another to fit into this framework, to adapt their discourse, to adapt to censorship. And then there was this slow evolution and ultimately the decision to publish in the West, which did not come about easily. So for me, it was interesting to look precisely at this transition, the way in which their discourses evolved. And it's very interesting for this to look at Roy Medvedev's figure, because you would say he was this convinced communist. Why did he publish in the West? There's this kind of contradiction. And we can really follow his archival fund is great in this way, because we have several versions of his manuscript. And the first version from 1964, which was just before Khrushchev asked her, we can see that it's a work that could potentially, if the situation had evolved differently, it could potentially have been published in the Soviet Union, because it was still very much inscribed in the framework of Khrushchev's secret speech. It was not highly subversive. Then we can see when we look at the version from 1966 and then the one from 1967, we can see progressively how it is changing, and he encounters new sources. This is the time when he starts speaking with these old Bolsheviks, and his perspective evolves, because he realizes that the repressions were not only in 1937, 1938, that they began already at the end of the 1920s. And so he starts looking at new themes, the history of Soviet collectivization of agriculture and industrialization, etc. So we can really follow this evolution. And it's the same thing with the authors, the other authors that I look at. And for me, this was the most important, interesting aspect that I found in my research.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And I believe that the opportunity to work in his Medvedev's private archive must have been quite a unique experience. Now, I just want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your research with us. It's a fascinating story, and I think our listeners will very much enjoy reading your work. Before I let you go, I'm interested to know, what are you working on at the moment?
Thank you. So at the moment, I'm still studying the same period, but I've turned to the topic of religion, and I'm interested in how this late Soviet generations from the intelligentsia became interested in religion. We see this decline of communist ideology and this replacement by a new national identity, depending on the Soviet republics. I'm looking at Russia. So this is the Russian national identity, and in this connection, this interest in religion, Russian Orthodoxy. So I follow this change from the 1970s to the 1990s. And I use all history, so like Medvedev, Antonov, Segre interview a lot of people, and this also has been for me a fascinating project.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrific project. And I just want to thank you again, Barbara, for joining us today on the New Books Network. And I wish you all the best for your next project. I hope to see you here again. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation.